Tech Dorks Podcast, where I, Rob Swindell, and my Canadian friend Stephen Hurd discuss things interesting to us and maybe to you, the listener. This show is an unscripted, unedited, unprofessional look into what interests Stephen and I, the only subjects off limits of the three W's, wives, work, and WWE. If you don't know the difference between SD and SSD, then this show may not be for you, but still, we hope you enjoy. Good evening.
Good evening. And welcome to my lair.
Yeah, so we're not dead. We just took a week off.
Well, we kind of alternated taking nights off, I think.
Yeah, well, you were out of town on the night, the scheduled night of the podcast recording.
I was.
And then we had a lot of stuff going on that week. We had school starting and volleyball tryouts and stuff.
And by we, he means not me.
Well, yeah, I forget. Oh, it was a Synchronet release. Oh, that was before you left, actually.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, you want to do a podcast night, and then, you know, you'd be like, ah, I'm tired, I'm going to sleep. So
yeah. You were ready, I wasn't invited.
Yeah,
for,
yeah. It was my fault that Monday. I mean, I'm actually going to be gone for a couple of weeks coming up soon, so it'll be interesting to see how we manage to make that work.
Yeah, maybe we'll do a remote thing.
Oh.
And I'm supposed to be going to China mid-September, but I think that's in the middle of the week, so maybe we'll do the Monday before I leave or something.
Well, I'm going to be gone on the 7th and the 14th, and the 14th is actually a travel day. It's my first big travel day, so I'm going to be driving like 12, 13 hours that day.
Yeah, you won't want to do it that day.
Eh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably not.
But if, like, a mobile on the road mumble connection might work if you have a microphone and a headset.
And a mobile on the road internet connection?
Or whatever, wherever you're staying.
Yeah, but if I'm on the road.
Oh, not while you're driving. I would try to do it while you're driving.
With three other people in the car.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't be fun. For them, you probably
wouldn't. Probably not. Yeah. Yeah, if I could actually hook it up so it came through the speakers in the car, I bet you they would have input for the show. Yeah.
They would be like, other people want to listen to this?
We're like, no, not really.
Yeah.
We have had as high as 5 listeners, so.
Yeah. The comments on the last episode tailed off. But that just might be the comments. I didn't actually look at like how many people downloaded the
or maybe
MP3,
it's just our least popular episode to date. You know, a new record.
Yeah, Windows 10. People weren't interested in that topic, maybe.
Well, and you know what? We already kind of beat it to death. So,
well, that was the episode where we beat it.
Right. So then, who wants to talk about us beating it? You know.
Right.
It's
I agree.
Inappropriate.
It's not a popular topic.
No.
I'm not going to record the video of this episode. The YouTube video didn't get a whole lot of views. I think we mentioned it got 25 views-ish. But, you know, if people request it or we're doing something where there's a lot of, you know, computer stuff that capturing and
I don't need to see.
Right. Well, help. You had Windows 10 and you could reproduce the same things we were talking about.
It did, but I think it would help even more if I could see what you were talking about.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. And we could do that as well, but it
we
gets
could.
More complicated.
Yeah. I mean, we're having enough problems just with what we're doing now, so adding a whole nother...
Yep.
Whole nother layer would be adding a whole nother layer.
Yep. I agree. No reason to get more complicated unless, I don't know, there's a good reason for it.
Yeah. So, since the Synchronet release, I committed my giant IPv6 patch from hell.
Oh, well, let me back up and explain that there what Synchronet is. Every listener probably knows Synchronet is a BBS program that I created in the...
I thought we covered that a couple of weeks ago.
Early 90s. I don't think I ever explained exactly, but...
Oh, okay.
That's probably how people that are listening to this podcast discovered us was through BBSing
or
Synchronet.
We become massively popular in the future, and they've come back to listen to all the original episodes.
Right.
I think
they're like,
more likely.
Look how quaint. They're talking about that old program.
Oh, wow.
Obsoleted. Back
sure
when
improved.
Windows was a thing.
That was when Windows 10 first came out.
And later they named it 1.0. Retroactively. So, yeah, there hadn't been an official new installer since, like, 2011, I think, or 2010, something like that. It's been a while.
I think it was older than that.
Anyway, it's been a while. Yeah, maybe it's been, like, 10 years. I don't remember. But that was the major reason for doing a release, was to generate a new, fresh installer, because people would have to install a very old version, just a 3.13, and then upgrade to the latest version. And if they wanted to, they could get the latest development release, which was the 3.16a. And that development release, you know, was going for years and years. So depending on when they got it, you know, 3.16a meant something different. But generally, they were all compatible with each other. But then if you installed 3.13 and you upgraded, you'd still have remnants of an old configuration, you know, what I thought were good default settings way back then. And, you know, those door games that were installed, some of them, I think, were 16-bit DOS. Yeah, 16-bit DOS programs had dependencies on a 16-bit message editor, a DOS message editor. I think it was FEdit. So, you know, those things were pretty clunky and didn't work with 64-bit operating systems, and we've since had a lot better alternatives in JavaScript and otherwise. So it was time for a new, fresh installer. And also, you had been working on sort of a side project of adding IPv6 support to Synchronet, and you were eager to get those changes committed into the official source repository.
Well, yeah, basically because the copy of the code I was working on was completely different from the copy of the code that everybody else in the world had. So anytime I had a small change to do, I couldn't just fix my copy and commit it. I had to figure out how to make that change in the old code that everyone else had.
Yeah.
And then connect to a different system where I had a pristine copy, make the changes there, build them and test them there, and then commit from there, which was just...
Right. And completely different is an exaggeration. You didn't modify every single file or anything. But,
no, I think I just modified all the ones that commonly get modified. You know, I didn't edit the Baja stuff.
Yeah.
Actually, I think I did. But, yeah, I didn't edit.
Well,
every
since then
file,
you did. You've, like, resolved some warnings and stuff. But so when there's an official release, that kind of marks a long period of stability to me. You know, this Synchronet, at least for Windows and Linux, has been very stable for a long time. Very little major changes have been made. So it was a good time to, you know, mark that point, mark it with a version, archive everything. And then now we can start breaking things again in the in our source code repository, which also gets built nightly into a development build. So the binaries, I think I put them on my board for Linux x64, but most people build from source on Linux anyway. And then they're available for Windows 32-bit. Mm-hmm. But right now, with all these major changes, you know, it's not going to be stable. It's not a stable release or a stable, you know, version by any means. So I don't really recommend people download the development version and try to run it right now.
Unless they want to find problems and get everything fixed sooner.
Yeah. But we're finding problems right now every day, so...
I'm not. I haven't found a single problem today.
Okay.
And you haven't reported a problem to me today, so...
When I got home from work...
No problems.
Yeah, when I got home from work, the web server was crashed.
Over. But you weren't running the one with the latest fixes.
That's right. I didn't have the latest 12 hours of changes, so I had to merge those in and then rebuild.
So yeah, no bugs yesterday, because today is actually... a new day. So yeah. We had a bug-free day already. But speaking of our source code repository, this is brought up. So we actually have like a, 15-year-old CVS repository.
Yeah. It was started like around 2000, 2001, something like that.
Yeah. And it's really irritating. I mean, it's
irritating
always been good enough.
To you?
Yeah. especially lately with this. So now that we've got this unstable version going along, I'm working on, so there's a lot of supplementary scripts that come with Synchronet, and I'm updating some of those, and unfortunately, they're not backward compatible changes. So if someone just grabs the newest scripts, they're not going to work. In fact, they're going to become broken. They used to work, they'll update, and they'll break, unless they update their whole system and break everything.
Right. You shouldn't use cvs.synchro.net as your source for updated JavaScript in this
right.
case.
But the other issue is that a lot of the people who work on these scripts are committing from stuff they're working on in 3.16.
Yeah.
So they're not even testing them with the new one, and they might be broken kind of thing. And so there could be a bit of a commit issue. And so branching becomes a useful thing. And
well, or
CVS
we could make the scripts compatible both ways.
Adding cruft. I mean, it would be obsolete when we add it, and it'll just get more obsolete as time goes by.
And but it is one way to solve that problem.
Right. You know. One way to solve the problem is to make the scripts bigger and more complex and harder to read. But you know, you prefer not to do that. So a better solution would be to branch. But branching in CVS is not a nice operation.
People that are modifying, like, you know, they have a door game, for lack of a better term. They have a JavaScript game for Synchronet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's synonymous with, like, a door game. And, you know, they're making their own changes to it. And if they want to keep a history of those changes, really they should probably have, like, their own source control system for that. And then if they want to make a release, you know, you want to release it, you know, especially if they're making a release for the current Synchronet release, 3.16, then you would make it through, like, the normal means of posting it on a BBS and a website, or, you know, FTP server, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, people have been using the Synchronet CVS repository sort of like a package management system or a package distribution system. And it's not that. I mean, it was never intended to be that. It's not. That only works as long as everybody's running the latest code out of the CVS repository. You know, you can't.
Right. And we're moving to a place where we don't expect that to happen. And that's where a branch would come in handy. You know, if we branch 3.16, they can make those changes on the 3.16 branch, and then they can be pulled forward as needed, kind of thing.
We can make a branch,
right? But merging specific changes between branches in CVS, is basically impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you can do it, but there's nothing to make it easier.
Yeah,
and so you know the whole, do we switch to Subversion? Do we switch to something else?
Does Subversion specifically address that problem?
Yeah, I believe that is specifically one that it was written to address.
Well, that is one of the... Well, I'd say that is probably the next tool or, you know, solution for source control that I had considered for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's similar to CVS in that it's open and free and... it supposedly performs better, and it's also very similar.
Yeah, it was specifically designed to be similar to CVS.
Right, but if it also solves this branching issue, then, you know, I'd be totally cool with you know, updating to software that's only 10 years old as opposed to 20 years old.
Yeah, and we also get a single monotonically increasing number that we can use to check if a particular feature exists. So if we add a feature in between releases and a script needs to test based on like a version number or something, or wants to because it's easier, you can't really do that in CVS because everything's per file. So, you know, when you update a file, its version gets updated, but nothing else does.
Right. And you were saying that there's not an individual revision that per file, like a monotonically increasing revision
per
file, which kind of, I do use that revision number, that CVS revision number to report the revision of certain subcomponents, and it'd be kind of a bummer to lose that. But, you know, that's something I think you and I, an exercise for us to do, you know, is look at Subversion as possible replacement.
I've looked at Git. It has things to recommend it, just not for this particular repo, really, is my opinion. Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the same. I've been looking at Git too, and it doesn't seem like the right tool at all to me.
But well,
maybe I'm biased.
I think you're biased, yeah. But since you're like the lead developer, your biases get translated into decisions. So,
well, like some things with CVS that were missing, like the kind of the history, like a nice, you know, change history, I addressed with my own script, right? It, you know, every commit gets logged into a message base, and then you can request that message base with a source, with a server side JavaScript program I wrote specifically for Synchronet. You know, and that I use that commit log all the time.
Oh, me too.
You know, and that's not part of CVS. I assume it's probably not part of Subversion either.
Well, there's a log.
Yeah, there's a very terse log that's part of CVS as well. If it's similar,
well, the CVS log is kind of irritating in a lot of ways. But the Subversion log, because everything's an atomic commit, it's a log of commits.
Yeah,
which is a lot like what you created.
That would be better.
Commits. Yeah,
yeah. Because right now, if you have changes like in different directories or modules in CVS, they all have to be committed separately.
Yeah.
And the only way they're really linked together is with your own description saying, you know, maybe these changes are dependent on these other ones, or they have the same description. But really, there's nothing that links them together with like a label or a number.
Right. And that's something that Subversion fixes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's possible we would switch to Subversion. It's highly unlikely we would switch to Git. It is.
Yeah, I'd have to really, really reverse my. Yeah, I'd have to totally reverse my feelings on Git before I would consider that.
Well, and you know, a lot of people they don't just want Git; they want GitHub, which comes with a lot of other extra workflow stuff that doesn't really match our model.
Right. Well, initially, I tried to use SourceForge, their CVS. Server, and it was just very slow, and then I think it was slow, and then the one day it was actually like down, and I'm like, well, how would this work for me? You know what I mean? I couldn't actually check in my code that day or get the latest code. You know, if somebody else made changes, that's totally unacceptable. So that was when I thought, well, it's better for me to run my own repository. And SourceForge, really, I've barely touched it at all. I did manage to put the recent releases for Windows on there. So it's kind of a mirror, just in case, you know, my system ever goes down. But I assume people are probably copying them, uploading them to other BBSs. So people still do that.
Yeah, I think if you were hit by a bus, we would scramble something together. I think the biggest issue would be DoveNet and getting control of that. I think
that'd be easy. You get control over the domain.
Right. I think then, I wouldn't have much problems getting control of the domains from your estate.
Yeah. And then just you can make dove.synchro.net point where, you know, your system, you become the hub or whatever. So,
well, I'd have to set up a new system, right? I mean, I have two BBSs, neither one of which is suitable as the hub, you know. So I would have to add at least one more system and...
But you get port 21's fine for you, right? For your home hosted BBS?
Yeah, port 80 is not.
Right, and port 80 is not really used for DoveNet. But,
no, but I mean, I would want a proper hub system. So I would want a replacement for Vertrauen or a... what do you
All
call
right,
that?
All right, let's stop talking about my death.
Wow.
I don't have any terminal illness that I'm aware of, so.
I'm actually curious how well the FreeBSD and OpenBSD, how well the Unix support would do if I died. You know, like, sync term would kind of be, that's the final version, and, you know, I think a lot of a lot of the sexy new features that don't really belong in a BBS that I add wouldn't show up.
So that brings up a topic that actually was on my sort of mental list to talk about that I didn't have on today's list to talk about. But there was always this myth, I believe it's a myth anyway, about open source. And people, you know, initially when I first created Synchronet, it was real popular, but everybody wanted the source code. So then I started selling the source code to some people. And then, of course, you know, that kind of turned out to be not very maintained. You know, I couldn't really continue with that model. So then I, you know, just went closed source and only sold binaries for a number of years. And then when, you know, that turned stopped being profitable, I just open sourced the whole thing again. And, you know, everybody had promised that if I just open sourced it, there would be all these people that would just be in line to enhance it and fix bugs and, you know, maintain it basically. And so like 97, I open sourced it and I just gave it like a public domain, you know, license. I didn't even GPL it.
Yes. I just said, SBBS 2 open source edition.
Yeah.
Or public domain edition or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. Mm. I don't think I used exactly those words, but I just made it public domain. It's like 2.3 something. And one guy, so Enigma, also known as Dink, I think that was sort of his hacker alias, he made a few changes specifically for OS2 to address some OS2 issues. But they were very small and they weren't necessarily the best way to solve the problem that was being solved. But I don't remember if he released executables or he just like emailed me some patches, but really other than that, for several years, or I'd say like 3 or 4 years, nobody did anything with it.
Right.
And so then I started, you know, bringing it into the modern era with multi-threading and TCP/IP and, you know, and then, you know, yeah, I think it was really when you started showing interest that I thought, okay, we need a source control system so we can coordinate.
I think that happened well before me.
Was it?
Yeah. Like, you got some patches from Angus, and you got some patches from, like, Kalia or something.
Oh, no, I didn't. I would never integrate anything from her.
No, and then you got that sound, the tone thing for Unix from someone else.
Okay. There was a guy named Casey Martin, I think. He gave me a bunch of patches for Unix, initial Unix support. I don't remember Tone specifically being part of that, but there was some other stuff.
Well, it might not have been Tone, but yeah. It was the stuff that beeped and stuff like that. I mean,
I think I did the beep stuff, but
not for Unix. No, you said that was someone's code. I don't remember.
Oh. Anyway, but I they weren't committing to CVS. I think the first person to ever have direct commit access to the source code other than me was you.
I think there was like 3 in there. Anyway, it's possible.
No, I don't. I think it really was first one other, and certainly, to, you know, there was a lot of people that kind of hit and run. They'd send me a bunch of diffs, and then I'd never hear from them again, or maybe hear from them for like a month, you know, and then be able to answer some questions, and then, you know, they lost interest in BBSing or whatever. Right. You know, you're obviously rare that you stuck around, but also, you know, just in general, I think, you know, I read the book. A cathedral and a bazaar.
Yeah.
And you know, I had already had this experience with Synchronet and open sourcing it and kind of being disappointed in the amount of actual programmer interest. Yeah. There's a lot of people that run it. A lot of people, you know, that would make claims that, you know, oh, if I only had the source code, I'd fix this myself. And if I only had the source code, I could, you know, I wouldn't have to ask you these questions, you know. And the truth is that those are lies. You know, most people are exaggerating what they would do if they had the source. And, you know, it's really it's honestly, I think it would be exactly the same if we closed sourced it and, you know, just you and I and maybe a handful of other people that expressed interest all wanted the source code. Other than being able to build it on other operating systems where we don't give out binaries, there's very little benefit from being open source.
I don't know. Anyway, I'm looking at the password file on CVS, and I am the 4th user. There is R. Swindell, which of course is you. There's D. Spielman, which I have no idea who that is.
Oh.
I think he was gone before I showed up.
I think that's Pistol Grip.
Oh, it could be.
Keep going.
And then there's C. Martin.
Casey Martin. Yeah, I guess he did. Okay.
Who I also don't recognize the name.
I think that's the name.
And then there's me. And then there's Render Wu, who did the whole web interface and then disappeared. And then Cyan, who did the IRCD and sometimes disappears. Sometimes he's back. Rune Master. Oh, wait. Did Rune Master do the web interface? Or was
it
Render Wu?
He updated it. No, Render Wu did the Linux DOS EMU stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. And then there's MCMLXXIX, or 79 as I call him.
Matt,
who does a lot of JavaScript stuff. And then there's Ree, which is a surprise to me. He actually does a lot of... He did a door game server with some bits of Synchronet, and he wrote Flash Telnet, or Flash Term and HTML Term.
I think that's why he has access, so he can update... stuff for Flash Term.
Yeah, I'm surprised he's got access, but he's there. And then eChicken is there, and he is also a big JavaScript guy.
Web guy.
He did a web interface as well, which is superior. Art, who did Fishing Game and some Raspberry Pi stuff, I believe.
Yeah, he also did like a drug dealing door game.
Oh, okay. I don't think I've tried that one. And then there's Night Fox, of course, the Sly Edit guy. And I think that's all he's done, right?
No, he also did like a message reader thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was in CVS or not, or if he just released it on his
I don't remember.
System. And then Nola Geek. And I recognize that, but I don't know what he's committed.
I don't think he's committed anything. I think he asked for access, and I gave it to him, but I don't think anything's been committed.
Oh, okay.
You can actually, that's one use for the CVS commit log.
is to see a log of commits?
Or who, exactly, who committed what. It actually counts the number of commits per user. And one thing you can do, if you put a post argument to the commitlog.ssjs, I think by default it shows 2,000 or 500 or 500 commits. So if you just, at the end of the URL there, you put question and then a number, that's the number of commits that it'll look back.
Yeah, that's not a post argument.
Oh, okay. Request argument, whatever. What do you call that?
When you do that, that is a query, and it was intended for searching. It's a particularly irritating thing to implement in a web server.
Well, anyway, if you put a number there, then it gives you that many commit, looks back that many commit messages. So the default's 500. Mm-hmm. Anyway, if I go back 2000, I don't see anything from Nola Geek.
I see things that were requested by him, but excuse me, I don't see any commits.
Well, look at the very end of the log. So if you go to cvs.synchro.net, listener, and you click on the commit log, and then you look at the bottom of the page, you'll see what we're looking at, but it shows statistics. So if you go back 2,000 commits, now that's going back to May.
Well, I've gone back 10,000, so it's going to take a while for the page to load.
Yeah, I don't think I even have that many.
I think you upped it.
Stored. So
I know I've got more than 10,000. I'm like 12,000 or something on mine.
Anyway, statistically, you are beating me, hands down, on commits. You have like 1,100, almost 1,200 commits going back to May of 2013. I only have 387.
Oh, jeez.
And eChicken has quite a bit, 211.
Yeah, no, he's definitely got quite a few. Okay, so here we are going back to Monday, February 4th, 2008. You have 1,712. I have 3,106.
Wow.
eChicken has 582. Night Fox has 126. SBBS has 44. I don't even... What?
Yeah, that's me logging into my Linux box and being lazy. That's what it is.
79 has 1,005. So he's actually catching up to you. Art has 123. Cyan has 75, and Ree has 48.
Yeah, nothing from Nola Geek, so...
Nothing from Nola Geek.
Yeah. And I've got a lot of commits to catch up to you.
Yeah. Well, if you do a lot of fix bug and last commit commits,
yeah,
I think that'll help a lot.
Yeah, that's all I need to do. I just need to make a typo in every commit, and then
follow. Fix typo.
So that way every commit is actually two commits.
Well, and I do have a lot of fix warning type commits too. I seem to fix warnings more often than you do.
Yeah.
Just do a sweep through.
Certainly lately.
Fix warnings.
Certainly lately. Anyway, so there won't be another Synchronet release very soon. But the next release, the big changes will be the IPv6 support, SSL support in the web server and in services. So, like, what services did you put it in? That was for that client that...
Well, I've got it in a bunch of them. Let me see my...
I thought it was that hot... What's it called? Hot chat or hot...
Hotline. Right? Yeah, hotline.
Yeah.
But that's not...
Which that's like another kind of proprietary BBS-like thing.
So we did have a bit of a technical glitch there. My Cox let me down.
Cox internet.
Yeah, and phone. I mean...
Wow. How'd you call him?
On my cell, of course.
Oh.
Yeah.
So when my internet... I also have my cable company providing my phone service, and when it stopped working, well, it didn't stop working recently. It got really, really slow.
Right.
And I called them from the home phone, which worked fine. And then, you know, I'm able to unplug the modem, the data modem, and the phones all still work. It's like a separate feed.
Oh, okay.
From the central office or whatever. Anyway, the point I was making was that that book, The Cathedral and the Bazaar, kind of makes a promise about open source that I have not found to be true. And I think it's very rare with some projects like Linux, the Linux kernel, and, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of others, maybe Apache or some web browsers or something. But I think the vast majority of open source projects are really one or two people, that's their pet project. And if they don't work on it, then really nobody works on it, unless there's some money to be made by working on it.
I'm not sure that I would say the majority. I mean, Synchronet, so first of all, the throw it over the wall type of open sourcing almost never works. I mean, there's a lot of businesses like... whatever the Synchronet business was, Digital Dynamics.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like Digital Dynamics that are like, well, you know, we're not making any money, we're closing down, and let's throw this code over the wall, and there we go. And, it, you know, none of that works. LBBS did the same thing, but lots of companies do that, and you can't expect that to work.
Was LBBS ever commercial? I don't think it was. Anyway, there's probably examples.
There's other ones I can't think of. Yeah. Anyway. It was definitely closed source. Anyway. And that type of thing, of course, isn't going to work. I mean, somebody who knows the code has to be working on it. And, you know, I think when you first open source Synchronet, there was nobody, like, you weren't really interested in it. Nobody was really interested in it, you know. So yeah. I think that's...
Well, there were people that were still running it and appreciated me making a release and making the code available. Obviously, like I gave that example of Enigma. He was still running the OS2 version and, you know, was interested in having it work the best that it could. And with the source code, enabled him to make some improvements there. You know, and he made them available to other people, but it wasn't anywhere near like you know, what it is when I was involved, you know, including now. But if you look at through SourceForge, you know, you'll find all kinds of projects that really have one person. And when that one person doesn't, you know, make commitments or commits, you know, changes to releases or whatever, you know, I mean, like, I can think of a lot of BBS examples. It's probably not a good genre to focus on.
The other thing I really did, so I wrote a TRS-80 Model 100 emulator years ago. And
it's an 8085.
Yes, it's an 8085, and I wrote the CPU emulator. I wrote the hardware emulation, everything. Right, I did the user interface. I did it all, and I open sourced it and dumped it up on SourceForge. And, you know, it did what I needed, and so I kind of stopped working on it. And then people showed up, adding a debugger and adding support for other similar models. And, I mean, it totally happened, and I completely did not expect that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think it's still active today. Let me see. They might have moved it off SourceForge, I guess.
So you haven't added anything to it since other people started contributing?
I've done a couple bug fixes here and there. I think like a year ago, I fixed a problem with the debugger that was reported. Here we go. Okay, so blah, there it is. Thing a thing. 5 stars. Tested under Windows 7. It's the easiest emulator I've used, and it works great. Yeah, okay. You know, and
so
I mean,
you have a success story. That's good.
Well, and it was something that didn't exist. You know, it wasn't something that you could find something everywhere. There was no fragmented development community, that kind of thing.
It wasn't like yet another Nintendo emulator or C64 emulator.
And I think that probably had a lot to do with it getting... What? That had a lot to do with it getting additional contributors. But yeah, okay, so the last commit... I made, wow, 11 years ago. So this is about the same age as SyncTerm, it looks like. Wow.
Oh, I thought it would have been older than SyncTerm.
I thought so too, but the initial import was 11 years ago. Anyway, my last fix was 7 months ago.
Wow.
You know.
A lot more recent than I thought.
But... The person who's taken it over has done most of the work.
Yeah.
But you know, it really worked out. I don't know how many people are actually part of... I mean, I think, yeah, I'm still the admin on the project. But I, you know, if I see an email about it and I happen to have some time, I'll work on it. But that's it. So, I mean, it does happen. But, you know, the Synchronet code base, when I started... was pretty bad. I mean, not that the code was bad. It just hurt to look at. You know, the formatting was horrible. You know, there was a lot of... It was horrible. It's not that it was different. It's that it was horrible.
Okay.
And, you know, there was a lot of things that seemed done in odd ways because... you know, of the code history. So it has a lot of, and still has a lot of legacy baggage.
Yeah.
So when you look at it, like, I want to just add this feature, and you look at it, it's like, wow, that's a lot more complex than I really wanted to do. It's hard to just add a feature.
And it's a mix now, it's a lot worse than it was in 97 in that regard, because it's a mixture of strategies or design approaches, styles, coding styles. You'll find mixtures of coding styles. Even if it's all, you know, code that was written by me, it's, you know, vastly different eras of my professional development and my experience. Yeah. So I approach problems in a different way.
I mean, different eras of hardware too. I mean, there's clearly parts of it where every byte matters and you don't want to have too much on the stack or too much on the heap. And then there's other parts that are just, sure, allocate whatever size that file is, allocate that much memory and just copy the whole thing into RAM, you know?
Yep.
So, I mean, it's, you know, a lot of it is just from how old it is and what it was originally written for. But, yeah, when I first approached the code base, it was very daunting. You know, it was like, oh, this isn't a simple task to just, you know, add this quick thing that I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I think I
can understand that, and it's
I had to write a CIO lib.
It's worse now in that regard.
I don't know that it's worse.
Well, it's more. When you first started looking at the code, it was about 2001 or something. It had already become a multi-threaded TCP/IP.
Yeah, it was already multi-threaded. C++ had FTP and
But when I initially open sourced it, it was. DOS. Pretty much a DOS program. I mean, I had OS 2, support, which did use multi-threads, but it was only for performance reasons. It wasn't for like multi-nodes where each node was a separate thread. It was still single process per node. It also built for Windows, for 32-bit Windows, although I think it was lacking a lot of functionality still. Mm-hmm. And it was console mode program, you know, and it was, like I said, pretty much a single instance per node. So that was the big change going to version 3.
Yeah. And then there was the Gopher server and...
Yeah, but that was the JavaScript stuff.
Yeah.
That's not really...
It's more like the FTP server, the mail server.
Yeah, yeah.
And really, the SMBlib by itself is daunting. I mean, just the message-based stuff has so many features that are not...
implemented?
No, that are implemented, but that are not obvious, right? Like the moderation stuff. How that works is not obvious. I can pretty much guarantee anyone who's not you or I who have done anything with messages has done the moderation stuff wrong, for example.
Yeah, it's not a commonly used feature as well.
Right, and there's a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, you created a new message, but you didn't, you know, flubble the nibbledy-doip in the header when you created it, so as a result, it's going to, you know, not work on some BBSs, you know. And there's just a lot of that. And I think that's...
A lot of flibbity noiks.
Yeah, and whippity boos and stuff.
Yeah.
All those things. And I think that was really a thing. But IPv6 is cool. And...
You're a lot more enthusiastic about that than I am, but...
I know.
I benefit from your enthusiasm, so...
Well... You know, we can't say we're a modern... networking program if we don't support IPv6. You know.
Okay. Yeah. I don't really worry too much about... I mean, I haven't had a lot of sysops. I can't really recall any saying, man, I really need IPv6 support. So,
well, you know, maybe it'll happen. But... I've got a list of the messages that were posted on DoveNet that are people asking for IPv6 support and getting excited about getting IPv6 support.
Yeah.
I didn't start the IPv6 support until there were like two other people who were like, yeah, no, I really want IPv6 support too.
Okay.
Then it looked like there was never going to be another release, so I started doing my own fork of Synchronet. It was close to forking. Mm-hmm.
That's fine. You fork it anytime you like.
Yeah, no, I fork it all the time.
Yeah.
I love forking. But, you know, and I was ready to just say, screw it. I'm just going to set up a whole different repo, put everything there, you know, and just not even worry about getting backward compatible. First thing I'll do is delete the Baja and the FidoNet code and all this legacy code that's garbage, and then I'm going to, you know... You know, all kinds of things. You know, I'll just delete all this stuff that I don't like and I don't understand.
Yeah.
That'll be gone.
A lot of it I don't like. Maybe I understand it because I wrote it, but, a lot of what you mentioned, like Baja and the FidoNet, well, some of the FidoNet stuff, certainly all the Netmail stuff that's highly integrated in Synchronet, that's on the chopping block.
Yeah. You know, and it was just, this has to go, it's not going. It was kind of a slow period in Synchronet development for like 2 years there.
Yep.
And I think a lot of people got frustrated. So it's great to have you back. We're all happy about that. And IPv6 is the future, so deal with it.
Yeah, one thing I missed on this release. So I made a couple... experimental installers for Windows, and I posted them, you know, with HTTP links on DoveNet, and apparently the people that installed it missed this as well as I did, but it didn't include the zip and unzip programs, and Synchronet does not have its own internal zip and unzip, you know, support. It relies on an external program for that, and you know, we use InfoZip, which is free, but I didn't include it in the installer. So I then made a 1 day or 2 days later, I made a Slipstream release. So there's a newer installer for the same version of Synchronet, which includes zip and unzip. File name's the same. It has the version numbers the same, but the date on the newer installer is updated. So that I don't like doing. But I wasn't actually changing the version of any of the executables within it. You know, I was just adding two files to the installation package. And I uploaded that to SourceForge as well. But it's possible that other people, you know, copied or uploaded the original release.
Well, and that's why I do, with SyncTerm, I do a source release, and then I do just a binary build release. And then anyone who wants to put together an installer... that's fine, but it's not the official release. The official release is a zip file for Windows and a tarball for everything that's just the source code.
Yeah.
And then...
well, I unfortunately, installing Synchronet from scratch into a new computer is not... a new Windows computer is not as simple as just unzipping something into a directory tree.
Right. Well, and SyncTerm should not be installed that way either. You know, it happens... it's... well, I don't know that it works on Windows 10, but I mean...
yeah, it still works if you just do it that way. If you just extract it into a directory and run the executable. Yeah. That'll work.
Yeah, but I mean... I don't expect people to download the zip and use that when I release the zip file. Yeah. It's just, this is the official binaries. They will never change. You know, if they ever change, there's going to be a new build. And then the installers and packages and that kind of stuff is all a different problem.
People like installers, though. I mean, there's even several longtime sysops that were asking me questions. As a matter of fact, the one guy that reported the issue about zipping and zip missing was a longtime sysop. So it's like, why is he installing it from scratch? You know, but they just, maybe they're not all that invested in their own custom configuration or whatever, their customizations. Well, so they want to install it from scratch just to get, you know, all the defaults again, you know, the default external program set up and all that.
And there's a lot of stuff, right? I mean, figuring out everything that you need to do to update. I mean, yes, there's zip files that you can extract over top of your existing install, but that feels really bad.
It works. That's how you do the update. I mean, I do have an upgrade archive for 3.16, and that's exactly what it is. You just unzip, you know, everything into the exec directory, and you're done.
Right, and that feels bad on Windows, I mean, or OS 10 or something. Mm. You know, I feel bad doing that. I would feel bad doing that on FreeBSD. You know, it just feels like the wrong way to do stuff.
Well, an installer is nice because then you're not going to make a mistake. You just hit next,
right.
Done,
and
or whatever.
An installer that does the upgrade for you is even nicer.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. And that's what I meant, is an installer that does an upgrade that doesn't rely on any, for you to type anything where you could accidentally type something wrong.
Or
miss
it
a step.
Prompts you for stuff that's changed, kind of thing. Like, oh, right. Do you want to enable this new cool feature or something like that?
Yeah, but it's 100% backward compatible. I mean, it's backward compatible to 3.15. So as long as you're already running 3.15 or 3.16a, then, you know, it's fine. You can just override the executables and all, if you want to, all the scripts as well. Mm. You know, you should, anyway.
Well, I think the mods directory is still gaining mind share in the Synchronet sysop community.
Right. No, so if you have a modified script in your exec directory, you want to move it in your mods folder, and then it'll continue to execute that one instead of whatever's in exec. So if you do update and it overwrites the script with the same name in the exec directory, it doesn't make any difference. You don't lose your own custom changes. So that's what the mods directory is for.
Right. And the issue with the mods directory, of course, if you have just a couple small changes to a script and it gets changed upstream, you have to manually remake those same changes and copy it over, and you have to look for them.
Yep.
You know, and that's kind of irritating.
Yeah, but at least you have the original and then the new one. You can do a diff.
Yeah.
You know, so if you don't know how to do a diff, then I'm sorry.
This podcast isn't for you.
In Windows, there's a command line program called FC for file compare.
Oh, it's horrible.
And on Unix, there's something called diff. D-I-F-F.
Diff is available for Windows, too.
Oh, yeah.
Please,
sure.
Please do not use FC for it. It's
I use
so
FC
bad.
Sometimes.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
Do you have diff on your Windows box?
Probably. Let me see here. I'm sure
do
I have diff and patch. Yeah, I have it. I use it sometimes. I usually use WinDiff, which is a Microsoft
nice.
Visual yeah. diff. If you can do a colorized graphical diff, that's usually preferred to something on the command line. I had some ideas for some other topics.
Okay.
So we were talking about Windows 10 in the last episode, and this isn't really necessarily Windows 10 specific, but I had the opportunity to kind of put a touchscreen system through its paces, you know, kind of experiment with one. And, it's running Windows 10. It's like a 23-inch all-in-one computer, you know, with a touchscreen. And so I kind of imagined, the kids would like to play with this thing, my wife, because it's like a giant iPad conceptually. Except it's running Windows. Well, no, it turns out it really is. The kids have all said that. They said, this is like a giant iPad. It's too heavy. You can't put it in your lap or anything. You know, it's just stationary there, you know, in our kitchen. But, they all have been doing their homework on it, playing Minecraft on it, playing all the Windows Store games that are, you know, or similar games that they also have, like, on their iPads or other tablets or whatever. And they love it. And I found that it's nice for like, you know, I was taking video of, my oldest daughter volleyball tryouts and I was showing them to my wife and like, that was a very convenient system to do it on. Cause it was right there, big screen, touch screen. You flip through the videos, hit play, you know, with your fingers and everything. I actually like it more than I thought I would. And the kids love it.
Yeah, no, I expect when I get around to doing that I will actually enjoy it, but I will not put it at, like, a seated thing, like you said you were going to do, and I assume you did.
No, I put it on a bar, kind of like you suggested.
You did.
Yeah, I put it on the breakfast bar, which is in our kitchen, so you can either sit at a stool, like a tall
stool, okay.
Or you can stand there and use it either way.
Yeah, that's better than my original suggestion.
And it's being used all the time. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of the new thing, too, right? Anytime you get a new toy, everybody wants to play with it. And then you kind of discover whether or not it's truly useful or not after a week or so.
But, yeah, I really think that where a big touchscreen really comes into use is when it is something you walk up to and use. So it's at counter height or above kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not something you expect to sit down at and have a keyboard and mouse in front of you. I mean, because at that point, it's like you have a keyboard and mouse. Why would you touch the screen?
Well, I did hook up a keyboard and mouse. I didn't initially, but I did later because I found that there's still rough edges. Like the browser does weird things where, you know, you're clicking the link and it just won't take you there. You know what I mean? And I don't know why, but you click it with a mouse, it works fine. So
yeah, and having the keyboard for typing is nicer than the on-screen keyboard.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, but it's still kind of the walk up and use for a couple minutes type of utility that, you know, a desktop really doesn't have. You know, you sit down and you do stuff, and you don't, if you're sitting, you know, watching TV or something, you're like, oh, you know, commercial's on, I want to just quickly check my email. You don't really want to get up, walk over to your computer, sit down, check your email, get back up again, walk over. You know, so, you know, tablets have kind of taken over that. But, I mean, if you want to send an email with a keyboard or something, still, it would be nice to have something you just walk up to, use, and walk away from. So,
yeah, and we already have a computer that's pretty conveniently located to our family room television. It's usually off or asleep. Whereas this computer is also usually asleep. It seems to wake a lot quicker, but that's just a function of being probably, you know, more modern hardware.
And a more modern OS, too. Yeah.
And, if you know, it's a pretty new install and everything hasn't had time to be corrupted by malware.
They really went to the suspend SSD, and Microsoft really pushed the hardware vendors to get that wake from sleep and the initial power on times way down from where they were before Windows 8. So
Now, it does not wake when you touch the screen, though, which is kind of a bummer. You have to actually,
there's
like...
There's not an option in the BIOS setup or anything?
I don't know. I didn't look for one of those. If you hit the, you know, the mouse or a key on the keyboard, then it'll wake.
Yeah.
Or hit the power button. But touching the screen doesn't wake it up. And the camera in it is a real disappointment for, you know, the
rear-facing
camera.
The rear-facing camera?
Well, the camera that faces you.
That's the front. You sit in front of a computer.
Okay, sure. Then the only camera. I think it only has one camera.
Right, but it faces the front of the computer.
Well, I know, but like I think on a cell phone, they call it a rear-facing camera, is the one that faces you, the person using the phone. That's the rear-facing camera, and then the front-facing camera is the camera that points out.
The one that faces the rear of the camera is the front-facing camera?
I don't know. On a phone, I think that's usually what they call. The rear-facing camera is usually a lower-quality camera, and then the higher-quality camera is the one...
The front-facing camera is a camera on the front of the phone facing the user.
Oh, then I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, front-facing camera. So that one is kind of... It's pretty disappointing in quality, but... Anyway,
they usually are. Yeah. The front-facing camera is the one that's supposed to be disappointing in quality because it's for FaceTime and that type of thing. It's not for actual cameraing.
Right, but my kids do a lot of Skyping and stuff, and you know, they also like when you log in and create a Windows account. You know, it wants you to take a picture of yourself.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, and you know, it's we generally do that, so it's easy to recognize yourself real quick when you're looking to log in.
That's a topic. I hate people on Facebook and other things where the place where it's supposed to be a picture of them so you can figure out whether you know them or not is a picture of their dog or a picture of them when they were a kid.
Yeah, that's
or,
me.
You know, like a picture of a tree or something.
My current Facebook like photo is me on a horse when I was like 7.
Yeah, it's really, really irritating. So you send someone a friend request and they're like, I don't want to be friends with some kid or a dog or whatever. I mean, seriously, the thing that's a picture of you, make it a reasonably current picture of you, please, as a favor to me.
Yeah, well, it was before I changed it to that, but I was active in a horse-related discussion group.
And that was the most recent picture you had with you and a horse?
No, it wasn't, but it was proof that I... have been riding horses since I was 7, off and on. So another thing I wanted to mention was I bought a Chromecast, I don't know, like a year or so ago. And the thing, when it does work, which right now it's not working, it's probably dead, but it's always been incredibly irritating and difficult to use and unreliable and... very annoying. And now it's like, I don't know if it was because I left it plugged in for so long, it got hot or something, but most of the time when you plug it in the TV, it won't power up. And then when it finally did power up this last time, then it had to do an update from Google, and then it wouldn't power up again after that. And it's just, you know, the thing's so difficult to use anyway, because you have to have like a tablet or a cell phone as well to control the thing. And they both have to have Wi-Fi reception the whole time, be on the same network. And then if your phone like loses reception or whatever at any time, then it becomes totally out of sync and you can no longer stop the video or pause it. And
yeah, I bought a Miracast dongle or Miracast, I don't know. And it's kind of a similar thing. You know, it's you send video to it over Wi-Fi. And it's got a useless little antenna, and I put it behind my TV, which I have a lot of RF noise behind my TV because I've got, you know, my amp and the TV. You know, my TV has a big silvered mirror in it, which doesn't help. There's fans all over the place. There's, you know, all kinds of... I've got a gigabit Ethernet back there. All kinds of stuff that, you know, I cannot actually connect to it over the network. And the access point is like 8 feet away through a wall, but it's only like 8 feet away, and it doesn't have a reliable connection to my network. And
you can't use like a, well, first of all, you can't plug Ethernet into it.
Correct.
And you can't use like a cable, like an HDMI cable to extend it and get it out from behind the TV.
I probably could. I haven't tried that. And then it's got the Apple mode, where that Apple did, which is a point-to-point Wi-Fi. So it's not even through my access point.
Yeah.
It directly connects to there, which, of course, is even worse because I've got a crappy little antenna behind the TV and a crappy little antenna in the iPad, you know, inside a metal case, which is not the place to put an antenna. And, you know, together, it's like, you know, I'm lucky to get like a frame a minute kind of thing. It's so that was a real disappointment. It was a waste of $5 or whatever I spent.
Now, the Amazon Fire TV, it comes in both a standalone box, which is kind of like a Roku, and it comes in a stick version, which is similar to like the Chromecast.
Yeah.
But it comes with a remote. And not only that, it's an RF remote. So it doesn't matter if the thing is behind the TV, you don't need infrared, you know,
to reach it. Assuming that it's like the 900 megahertz band and it has a reasonable antenna. I mean, you know, it's assuming it's somewhere that doesn't have a lot of interference or other stuff going on, I could see that working well.
In my tests, it worked well. I don't to say I own one, I bought my father-in-law one and it's in use in the house. So,
well, I've been considering a Roku.
I've actually bought, I had an old Roku. It's now so outdated, you know, you can't update it or anything and it doesn't support like the newer apps and stuff. But, really, the main reason why I started looking into the Amazon Fire TV was for Plex. And Plex is one of these Xbox Media Center. That's another example of an open source project that's, I think, taken off pretty well. Originally developed for the first generation of Xbox, it's a Media Center. I think it's based on Linux. But now I think, you know, they can run on Windows and Android and, you know, other maybe FreeBSD, I don't know. Anyway, so Plex is kind of like if you want to run your own streaming video from your own server to your either within your house, just to your own devices, or you can share with family and friends for your own ripped movies or home movies that you record, even music. It'll do, you know, streaming music. And I originally bought a Samsung Blu-ray player, which I could, you know, run Plex on, and that worked pretty well. You know, we don't really watch very many Blu-rays. So I was kind of looking at the Fire TV, and I ended up buying one for my in-laws, and I bought them also the stick version. And they both work great. And the box version is actually a little bit better because... Well, I think it has more memory and has a faster processor, but also generally, you know, if you have like a surround sound system, you usually want to run your audio to your audio video receiver. And if you plug one of these sticks into your TV, you've got to then run the audio out of your TV back into your receiver.
Right.
To get the surround sound coming through your receiver with like, you know, your other sources.
Right. But who doesn't do that?
It can complicate the wiring, you know, depending on if you're already, you know, wired up for that. You know, for my in-laws, for example, you know, they had surround sound in one room with a dedicated AVR and then the other room was just the TV. So the stick really made sense in one case and not the other. Also the box version, since it's more powerful, supports more games like Minecraft and you can order it with a remote and it's very much like an Xbox 360 style remote. And you can play a lot of these games, which I think are just ports from Android or whatever. You know, there's a big hit with the kids. They instantly were playing multi-user Minecraft with, you know, some people playing on iPods and other people playing on Kindle tablets and, you know, another person playing on the Fire TV, you know, with a big screen TV and a nice remote. And, you know, just everything worked. And it's just, it's not, I think they're like, the stick is like $40. It's not much more than the Chromecast. And the fact that it comes with a remote, doesn't require a separate device, like a tablet or a phone, you know, makes it a breeze to use. It works great for Netflix and all the other embedded content. If you want to, you know, buy content from Amazon, movies and stuff, you can. Yeah. There's a lot of free content, a lot of games.
Yeah, I really think the smart TV is dumb.
Oh, building all that into the TV itself.
Right. Building it permanently with a specific set of hardware forever for your TV.
Well, a lot of them you can download apps, but there's you're still going to be limited. But
you can
on the
until
capability
they stop
the
supporting that platform.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
and I don't own a TV that's that new. Like, I don't have a single TV that is supports like apps, for example.
Hmm. I've got a couple. That's not that new. I mean, they've been doing it just poorly for a very long time. It sucks bad, and they stopped supporting it after like 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And I mean, the lifetime of a TV is like 10-20 years at least.
Yeah, my newest TV, I bought it because it was, a discontinued model. You know, I got a good deal on it.
Yeah, same with me. That's how I bought my 92-inch TV.
Yeah, but that was a lot more recent than my most recent TV.
Yeah. I mean, well, yours is the one in the living room, right?
Yeah. I bought it, you know, like maybe 8 years ago. Nine years ago, something like that. It doesn't,
8 years ago
doesn't
they
do
ran
apps.
Smart TVs.
Well, this one didn't. It doesn't have Wi-Fi. It doesn't have...
Both my TVs are wired Ethernet.
Oh.
Neither one is Wi-Fi.
Well, this doesn't have any network connectivity at all. It's just good TV, but it's just not a smart TV.
Yeah,
and even the Blu-ray player, I find, is kind of silly now. We never watch Blu-ray discs. You know,
so
a
you
lot of times...
You don't rent from Redbox?
Nope.
Nope. See, Redbox is still a third the price of streaming, and it's better quality still.
Do you get Blu-rays or do you get regular DVDs?
I get Blu-rays.
Well, I haven't. I don't think I ever rented. Oh wait, maybe sometimes we did get Blu-rays from Redbox, but no, we stopped getting Redbox a while back.
Yeah, for a while, a DVD was $1 and a Blu-ray was $1.50. So we would only get the Blu-ray if it was like an action movie or something that was visually stunning. You know, and we'd save the 50 cents and get the DVD for the rest, like for comedies and romances and that kind of thing. And then they increased the price of DVDs, and so it was like, well, you know, why would I get the DVD anymore? So yeah, now we just get the Blu-rays. And we probably rent a couple every month from Redbox. Just because, you know, to get 5.1 audio and 1080p video renting from like Vudu or any
Hulu,
of those
Amazon
Xbox video or Amazon or whatever costs like $5-6.
Yeah. And yeah, we've done that. That's what we've rented lately.
Yeah. And for $1.50 I can, you know, go 4 blocks down to Albertsons and pick it up at the Redbox. I mean,
yeah, but then you have to get it back the next day, and that's where we, you know, failed. And ended
well,
up
you have
more.
A week to get it back and still not pay more than streaming it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, then it's still a hassle. You know, if it ends up being the same cost. And actually, I think it was if you brought it back like a day late, it ended up kind of breaking even with the streaming, which is way more convenient.
Well,
it depends
on if you get the full quality stream or not. And it really irritates me that they upsell that.
Yeah, we usually would get 720, I think.
Yeah. But, yeah, and I mean, I drive right past it on my way to work, so it's never a problem to drop it off. And, I mean, we're like 4 blocks from the Redbox, so it's not, you know, an issue. I don't know. You're probably further away from your nearest one. But you'd still drive past it on the way to work, right?
A lot of times I'd forget to put it in the car. Or, you know, my wife said she was going to do it, and she didn't. And
That's a W.
Oh, yeah. Oops.
But
the woman that I live with, the mother of my children.
One of the women I live with, yes. But yeah, we still use Redbox, although it's starting to get less. I don't know if it's just movies have sucked lately, or what, but I know that I can rent the new Age of Ultron streaming, and I can't get it at Redbox yet.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with that movie yet.
What?
No.
The new Avengers movie. It's like a year old now.
Seriously? Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the Avengers series.
Huh.
It's all right.
I see. I guess it's not Redbox.com or their gone. It is redbox.com. Oh, that time it worked. I don't know. Let's see. Age of Ultron. So did you read comics growing up at all, or?
Yeah, but, you know, that was 5 years before you. So I don't, you know, I don't remember if we had Avengers or not. We might have had a few Avengers. I seem to recall the cover of a couple of Avengers. I wasn't a huge fan of them, but we did have a bunch. My brother and I. So maybe he was the bigger fan than I was. But we, you know, we had some old Superman, Batman, Fantastic Four, you know, Popeye and Archie and Veronica, whatever.
I hear they keep talking about making a movie. So it looks like Age of Ultron is available at Redbox. It just wasn't at the one I was at.
Mad Magazine. Now, I like Mad Magazine.
They're making a spy versus spy movie.
Oh. Cracked was always kind of a cheap knockoff to me. You know, it was a cheap copy of Mad Magazine. Mad Magazine was good.
Mad Magazine was a cheap copy of Mad Magazine. I mean, really, it's...
Yeah, well...
It wasn't really the big... What's the word? I don't know. But...
Je ne sais quoi?
But I did enjoy Mad Magazine. And Cracked wasn't as funny.
Yeah.
It was more raunchy than funny.
I liked the spoofs, the movie spoofs that they had in Mad Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cartoons, obviously. Dawn, what's his face? I want to say Knotts, but that's the actor. Anyway, the different cartoonists.
Don Martin,
yes. And there was the guy with the frizzy hair. Al Jaffe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Jaffe. Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. So, you know, those guys, I think, those magazines I was a lot more into than your superhero comic books.
Yeah. Well, I happened to be in right when the Wolverine hit its stride again, and the Hulk, and those kind of comics. So I did follow those for a while. Not, you know, insanely or anything, but enough that when they were making movies, I was like, yeah, I'll take a look. And they've done a pretty good job. So,
I wanted to share a little computer experience I had. And this is not, I'm sure it's not uncommon, whatever. But my neighbor, they got a new desktop PC. He said he got it a month ago, but he finally got around to setting it up like 2 days ago. He doesn't listen to the podcast, so we won't be offended. But they have security cameras that hook up to the computer, and I recommended to them Blue Iris software, and I actually ordered the cameras for them, you know. So, and I set them up the first time. Well, now they got a new computer, and of course, they don't know how any of that stuff works, and nothing works, and, you know, I'm over there. They've had the computer, set up running, you know, Windows for, 2 days. And, you know, I sit down, and, you know, the first thing is... they don't know any passwords for anything. You know what I mean? They don't know the password for their access point.
Right.
They don't know the passwords for the cameras. They don't know the password for
anything.
It's just, you know, we had to sit there trial and error figuring out passwords. You know, and then, of course, you know, I was going to shut down the computer, so I was going to plug in the other computer because they didn't have, another, you know, extra monitor or anything. So I was going to plug in the old computer so I could see the configuration on the cameras. Maybe you get a clue about, IP addresses and port numbers and stuff. And start shutting down the computer, and it says applying updates, and it has to go through. It says 72 updates pending, you know. It's Windows 7. And I'm like, is this the first time you've turned the computer off, you know? Anyway. So when you finally get it rebooted and everything, it's an hour later, it's this new computer, you know, it's plenty fast, dual core with 8 gigs of RAM, 64-bit OS, but not a speed demon, no SSD, so it's kind of chugging the hard drive. Anyway, finally get it up, and there's these ads popping up, you know, apps, you know, and I'm like, I'm getting that, you know, I don't know, you know, why that's happening. And I'm like, well, it looks like your computer's infected. He's like, well, there's no way. The only thing I've installed is Office. And, you know, that's it. you know, and I'm like, well, somebody did something because I don't think it came this way, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm looking, this processes, I'm killing them. They keep popping back up. He has AVG installed. It keeps detecting adware, like the same one over and over and over again. Keep, you know, you hit clean or whatever, and it just pops back up another 5 minutes later, detecting the same one. And then I'm seeing other processes getting added. It's like the computer is reinfecting itself in real time.
Right.
You know, it's just getting worse and worse as I'm sitting there. And he's like, you know, no, the only thing my son played some games on here, you know, and I'm like, oh, you know, what game was that? You know? And he's, oh, I don't know, maybe a web game, or he has no clue, you know, what his son did with the computer. You know, so I go through program files and I'm deleting some stuff, but really most of this is just malware, you know, so it's not really exposing itself to the normal methods of removal. You know, download malware bytes, run that. It detects like 36, you know, whatever problems, they call it. Yeah, issues, 36 yeah. issues, problems, right? Starts cleaning it. And I'm like, you know, are you administrator on your computer? And he's like, no, I wouldn't, no. And I go and check, and surely he is, you know. Hmm. He's like,
well, someone's got to be, might as well be him.
Yeah, well, that must be the default. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't want to be administrator on your own computer, you know. And he also had a new laptop, or newer laptop, and I checked, and certainly he was administrator there as well. Mm. And I kind of gave him the whole spiel about, you know, you don't want to be administrator. Certainly you don't want your kids to be administrator on your computer, but, you know, if you don't really know what you're doing, you know, you don't know what looks like a suspicious website or email or whatever, you shouldn't be administrator on your own computer. At the very least, it'll give you that pop-up that'll ask you for the administrator password, and it'll kind of give you a clue that something's trying to install something where it shouldn't.
Something bad is happening.
Yeah, something you don't expect. Now, if you're installing a new device driver or something and you're expecting that, then, you know.
Right.
But, and then, you know, after it finally cleaned up all the malware, the cameras no longer worked. And I went and I was like, I was just going to check some stuff, make sure the servers were still running, and I don't know what, but I ran Netstat and it wouldn't show any IP addresses. And it was like, oh man, this computer, you know, like removing the viruses removed something in the network stack. You know what I mean? And it could still connect to websites and stuff, but you know, some things weren't working right.
Yeah.
But, and I was like about ready to restore it to factory settings, you know, go back to the recovery partition and just, you know, re-image the machine. When I searched for a Microsoft Fix It article, you know, typed in the error message that was showing up in the Blue Iris web security software, which was like some WinSock error, you know, like it was like 10,027, I think. And it sure enough pointed to a Microsoft Fix It article. You have a corrupted, you know, WinSock or network stack or whatever. And, you know, if you run this thing, it'll probably fix it. And then sure enough, it did, you know, reboot later.
System file checker.
No, it was specifically for this particular corruption in the network stack. It was not a system file checker. Because one of those pieces of malware had inserted themselves, you know, probably into the name resolution or something. And then like when the, security software was trying to talk to the webcams, it was just going, you know, HTTP via IP address, but the error was like, name could not be located or something, you know, had the word name in it. And I'm like, that's not right. And then when I ran Netstat and it wouldn't even show IP addresses, you know, it was just like blank. I'm like, oh man, your machine's hosed, you know? And he was just like looking at me like with befuddlement, like, you know, I didn't do it. And I'm like, well, someone did, you know, like, a ghost.
And you want that to never happen again. So.
Right.
Let's make that not happen.
Yeah. So he's totally cool with, you know, creating user accounts for all the, members of the family and making them standard users, and you know, they can give them they can all have their own passwords or whatever, but you know, a lot of people, it's inconvenient, you know, you walk up to the computer, it's not logged in as you, it's logged in as somebody else, you just use a computer under that name, or you give them your password, and you know, but I'm just like, no, this is because his old computer, you know, I mean, yeah, it's an older computer, but it was just riddled with malware. And every time I had to go over there and work on the computer, it was just a torturous. I mean, it would take an hour to do anything because it was so infected. And once they reach a certain critical, you know, threshold of infection, you can't fix it because you can't resolve all the issues faster than it like self-infects, you know, because they open doors and other things.
And they'll break things that nobody knows about.
Right. Like right. that network stack issue, the name resolution issue, which is, yeah. you know, happened to be there was a Microsoft Fixit article that did work. You know, it didn't mention any of the malware or anything. It just said if you right. have a corrupted network stack and it gives you this error, this run this program and it solves it.
Yeah. Well, I encountered a similar thing, although it was a call from Microsoft saying that there was a problem with her computer. And, you know, I went over there and worked on it. I actually got it cleaned up and everything because, you know, she called me right after she hung up on the guy after realizing something was wrong. And she called me and I said, just power off your computer. I'll be by on the weekend. Don't turn it on for any reason.
You know, oh, so she actually let him, like, install software in her computer?
She let him connect and then she was like, no. This doesn't make any sense. So then, you know, she stopped and I was like, power off your computer right now. Do it now. Okay. Yeah.
The Microsoft scam.
Yeah. So I went there and I finally got everything fixed except if she's logged on as her user, she cannot download files through Internet Explorer. They just will not save.
Yep.
And
so you install Chrome or some other browser.
Yeah, I installed Chrome and Firefox and said, you know, if you need to fix it, we'll just create you a new user. Yeah. And I tried it. I tested it. I created a new user. Everything worked.
Yeah.
So it was just her user that was messed up.
Yep.
I've
had something very similar with my in-laws and their computer. And, you know, their son had, you know, corrupted it to a certain point. I was able to fix everything but Internet Explorer with one certain website. And I was like, you know what, just don't use Internet Explorer for that website. Use this other browser. And
that's the problem with Windows is it's so complex and so much is hidden that you can't troubleshoot it. You know, even if you called Microsoft, they couldn't troubleshoot it. They would tell you just wipe and reinstall.
Maybe. I consider myself lucky being able to fix their issue. You know, once I removed the malware, you know, the computer was in a worse state. You know what I mean? And I'm like trying to defend my actions and say, you know, the malware had inserted something in the computer and by removing it, we've now crippled the computer.
Right.
But that's not my fault. You know what I mean? You couldn't leave the infection there. But you know, I, like I said, I consider myself lucky that Microsoft actually had what they call a little fix it program, fix up, whatever they call it.
Well, I booted a Windows XP system for the first time in 8 years this weekend.
Your computer, you have a Windows XP system?
Yeah, it was a gift. It's an obsolete laptop, and it was only ever used for like two things. It was a audio installer guy, and he had some audio design software, and he only used it to take an audio layout to the customer, and it had like peripherals and stuff. Anyway, and that's all it ever did. So it wasn't even, you know. It still had dial-up configured. I opened up Internet Explorer on it, and it's like, connect to Earthlink? And I'm like, no, geez, how do I turn that off? You know, so I'm like, no, just connect. So it's like, you know, connect through the network. I'll set up the internet. There we go. Okay, connect through my network. And then it kind of sort of worked, but it still didn't work with Internet Explorer. So I'm like, okay, do not dial a connection. There we go. Okay, found it. You know, all this just ancient stuff that I had completely forgotten.
Yeah.
So I finally got connected through the LAN, and boy, was setting up a Wi-Fi connection nightmarish back then. You know, it was just a horrible little Intel program that did horrible things and with a horrible UI that, oh, it was terrible. And then, you know, I get it all hooked up to the TV and everything, because the main reason I needed it was to use Hulu, because if you use Hulu from a computer, you get access to more TV shows than if you use it from, you know, a TV or a tablet or something like that. So it was like, well, you know, we'll watch this show, and the only way to get it is to use it on a computer.
The same thing on YouTube. Some content you can only watch on a computer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I get it all set up and everything, and then it turns out the show that we wanted, we have to get that channel through our cable provider. Our cable provider is in Canada, so we signed in with him, and it says, well, you're not in Canada, so this isn't going to work. So it's like, okay, fine, whatever. So I go to shut it down, and I'd actually tried doing Windows updates when I connected.
Which pops you into a browser, i.e. 5.
Pops you into the browser, i.e. 6 it was.
Okay.
And, you know, it didn't work. It's like, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work. This, and I'm like, okay, well, whatever. It doesn't really matter. So I go to shut down, and it's like, installing 165 updates. Like, where did you get those from? Yeah. Windows Update isn't working. And where did you get 165 updates in this period of time that you were...
Was it SP3?
I don't know. Here, let's see. Where did I stick that? There it is over here. Let me power it back on. See.
Oh, no. We can't wait.
I'm assuming the battery is still good, which it's probably invalid. Oh, yeah. The green light came on. But...
Well, a similar story to this, the one I told about my neighbor's computer, happened with my dad's computer. I installed Windows 8 on his computer, and I went through all this setup, you know, trying to get all the software he uses working right and everything. And I forgot to make his account a standard user account.
Mm-hmm.
I left it as administrator. And, you know, throughout the week, he'd be calling me, oh, I'm getting these pop-ups, and I can't print, and it's doing this, and I can't, you know, whatever. And you try to install some PDF conversion software, which, of course, came with some adware, and it was all downhill from there. You know, I had to go.
Well, and since Windows Vista, even if your user's an administrator, it still prompts you for the administrator password to install stuff.
Not everything. Some things do, but you certainly don't get prompt as much when you're logged in as administrator.
Hmm.
And malware can you know, spread very easily. It doesn't. You don't get a whole bunch of authentication pop-ups. Now, I don't have that problem, right?
My computer never. Not a whole bunch is different to some, right? I believe that on Windows 8, he would have gotten an authentication pop-up and typed in his password. Not knowing why he was doing that.
No, I think all the stuff, the malware I saw was all like in his temp directory. So you can write there all day long as a non, you know, administrator password. But what it was doing was somehow, you know, getting the program loaded through the registry or whatever. It was, you know, having it, you know, reload as a browser extension or accelerator or whatever they call them. You know, but the actual physical location of the files, the DLLs and executables and everything was in his temp directory. So I think that's how they kind of get around a lot of those UAC pop-ups.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he entered his password at some point, not thinking that it was a bad thing to do.
Yeah.
The laptop is Service Pack 3 now. But it said it was setting up my browser when I first logged in. So I don't know if it was Service Pack 3.
Yeah, I'm surprised when I started. Hulu would even run on the old Internet Explorer.
Well, I installed Chrome and Firefox, you know, because it would run on one of those, I assumed. Yeah, I wonder if it updated Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer, there you are. Yeah, so... We don't actually know how long we've been talking, but it feels like it's been a while.
It has been. We're certainly over an hour. And we had the technical difficulties in the middle there, which I'll have to edit. So, yeah, I think we covered all the topics I had on mine to touch on.
Wow. He had a PDA package installed. Oh, wow. I think this is we've kind of wound down. So I think...
Now's a good time.
Yeah, now's a good time. Oh, we got a new outro.
Yeah. This will do for now. I don't. Not sure I'll stick with this, but this is Dresden.
Yeah.
It's kind of mellow.
Yeah.
It's a waltz.
Let's go with something else next week.
Okay.
Oh, it's installed Explorer 8.
Very modern.
Yeah.
All right. So next week, you heard it from the horse's mouth. All right. Take care.
You too.